Page 155. In the fascist countries, this mechanism facilitated the merger between private, semi-private, party, and public governmental bureaucracies. The efficient realization of the interests of large-scale enterprise was one of the strongest motives for the transformation of economic into totalitarian political control, and efficiency is one of the main reasons for the fascist regime's hold over its regimented population. At the same time, however, it is also the force which may break this hold. Fascism can maintain its rule only by aggravating the restraint which it is compelled to impose upon society. It will ever more conspicuously manifest its inability to develop the productive forces, and it will fall before that power which proves to be more efficient than fascism. In the democratic countries, the growth of the private bureaucracy can be balanced by the strengthening of the public bureaucracy. The rationality inherent in the specialization of functions tends to enlarge the scope and weight of bureaucratization. In the private bureaucracy, however, such an expansion will intensify rather than alleviate the irrational elements of the social process, for it will widen the discrepancy between the technical character of the division of functions and the autocratic character of control over them. In contrast, the public bureaucracy, if democratically constituted and controlled, will overcome this discrepancy to the extent that it undertakes the conservation of those human and material resources which technology and corporations have tended to misuse and waste. Footnote 31, text. In the age of mass society, the power of the public bureaucracy can be the weapon which protects the people from the encroachment of special interests upon the general welfare. As long as the will of the people can effectively assert itself, the public bureaucracy can be a lever of democratization. Large-scale industry tends to organize on a national scale, and fascism has transformed economic expansion into the military conquest of whole continents. In this situation, the restoration of society to its own right and the maintenance of individual freedom have become directly political questions, their solution depending upon the outcome of the international struggle. The social character of bureaucratization is largely determined by the extent to which it allows for a democratization of functions that tends to close the gap between the governing bureaucracy and the governed population. If everyone has become a potential member of the public bureaucracy as he has become a potential member of the masses, society will have passed from the stage of hierarchical bureaucratization to the stage of technical self-administration. Insofar as technocracy implies a deepening of the gap between specialized in common knowledge between the controlling and the coordinating experts and the controlled and coordinated people, the technocratic abolition of the price system would stabilize rather than shatter the forces which stand in the way of progress. Page 156. The same holds true for the so-called managerial revolution. According to the theory of the managerial revolution, footnote 32, text, the growth of the apparatus entails the rise of a new social class, the managers, to take over social domination and to establish a new economic and political order. Nobody will deny the increasing importance of management and the simultaneous shift in the function of control, but these facts do not make the managers a new social class or the spearhead of a revolution. Their source of income is the same as that of the already existing classes. They either draw salaries or, insofar as they possess a share in the capital, are themselves capitalists. Moreover, their specific functions in the prevailing division of labor does not warrant the expectation that they are predestined to inaugurate a new and more rational division of labor. This function is either determined by the requirement of profitable utilization of capital, and in this case, the managers are simply capitalists or deputy capitalists, comprising the executives and the corporation managers. Footnote 33. Text. Or it is determined by the material process of production, engineers, technicians, production managers, plant superintendents. In the latter case, the managers would belong to the vast army of the immediate producers and share its class interests, were it not for the fact that even in this function they work as deputy capitalists and thus form a segregated and privileged group between capital and labor. Their power and the awe which it inspires are derived not from their actual technological performance but from their social position, and this they owe to the prevailing organization of production. The leading managerial and directorial figures within the inner business sancta are drawn from or have been absorbed into the upper layers of wealth and income whose stakes it is their function to defend. Footnote 34. Text. To sum up, as a separate social group, the managers are thoroughly tied up with the vested interests, and as performers of necessary productive functions, they do not constitute a separate class at all. The spreading hierarchy of large-scale enterprise and the precipitation of individuals into masses determine the trends of technological rationality today. What results is the mature form of that individualistic rationality which characterized the free economic subject of the Industrial Revolution. Individualistic rationality was born as a critical and oppositional attitude that derived freedom of action from the unrestricted liberty of thought and conscience, and measured all social standards and relations by the individual's rational self-interest. Page 157. It grew into the rationality of competition in which the rational interest was superseded by the interest of the market and individual achievement absorbed by efficiency. It extended with standardized submission to the all-embracing apparatus which it had itself created. This apparatus is the embodiment and resting place of individualistic rationality, but the latter now requires that individuality must go. He is rational who most efficiently accepts and executes what is allocated to him, who entrusts his fate to the large-scale enterprises and organizations which administer the apparatus. Such was the logical outcome of social process which measured individual performance in terms of competitive efficiency. The philosophers of individualism have always had an inkling of this outcome, and they express their anxiety in many different forms, in the skeptical conformism of Hume, in the idealistic introversion of individual freedom, in the frequent attacks of the transcendentalists against the rule of money and power. But the social forces were stronger than the philosophic protests, and the philosophic justification of individualism took on more and more of the overtones of resignation. Toward the end of the 19th century, the idea of the individual became increasingly ambiguous. It combined insistence upon free social performance and competitive efficiency with glorification of smallness, privacy, and self-limitation. The rights and liberties of the individual in society were interpreted as the rights and liberties of privacy and withdrawal from society. William James, faithful to the individualistic principle, asserted that in the rivalry between real organizable goods, the world's trial is better than the closest solution, provided that the victorious keep the vanquished somehow represented. Footnote 35, text. His doubt, however, as to whether this trial is really a fair one seems to motivate his hatred of bigness and greatness in all their forms. Footnote 36, text. His declaration that the smaller and more intimate is the truer, the man more than the home more than the state or the church. Footnote 37, text. The counterposition of the individual and society originally meant to provide the ground for a militant reformation of society in the interest of the individual, comes to prepare and justify the individual's withdrawal from society. The free and self-reliant soul, which originally nourished the individual's critique of external authority, now becomes a refuge from external authority. Page 158. Tocqueville had already defined individualism in terms of acquiescence and peaceful resignation, a mature and calm feeling which disposes each member of the community to sever himself from the mass of his fellow creatures and to draw apart with his family and his friends so that, after he has thus formed a little circle of his own, he willingly leaves society at large to itself. Footnote 38, text. Autonomy of the individual came to be regarded as a private rather than a public affair, an element of retreat rather than aggression. All these factors of resignation are comprehended in Benjamin Constant's statement that our liberty should be composed of the peaceful enjoyment of private independence. Footnote 39, text. The elements of restraint and resignation, which became increasingly strong in the individualist's philosophy of the 19th century, elucidate the connection between individualism and scarcity. Individualism is the form liberty assumes in a society wherein the acquisition and utilization of wealth is dependent on competitive toil. Individuality is a distinct possession of pioneers. It presupposes the open and empty spaces, the freedom of hewing out at home, as well as the need to do so. The individual's world is a world of labor and the march, as Walt Whitman says, one in which the available intellectual and material resources must be conquered and appropriated through incessant struggle with man and nature, and in which human forces are released to distribute and administer scarcity. In the period of large-scale industry, however, the existential conditions making for individuality give way to conditions which render individuality unnecessary. In clearing the ground for the conquest of scarcity, the technological process not only levels individuality but also tends to transcend it where it is concurrent with scarcity. Mechanized mass production is filling the empty spaces in which individuality could assert itself. The cultural standardization points, paradoxically enough, to potential abundance as well as actual poverty. This standardization may indicate the extent to which individual creativeness and originality have been rendered unnecessary. With the decline of the liberalistic era, these qualities were vanished detaching from the domain of material production and becoming the ever more exclusive property of the highest intellectual activities. Now they seem to disappear from this sphere too. Mass culture is dissolving the traditional forms of art, literature, and philosophy together with the personality which unfolded itself in producing and consuming them.